Hi, everybody. My name is Angie, and I'm an alcoholic. My group is the Unity Group in Cincinnati, Ohio, on Monday evenings at 7 p.m. If you're ever in town, give me a call, and I'll take you there. My sobriety date is June the 20th, 1991, and for that, I'll be forever grateful. I am. Thank you, Lee, first of all, for having me here, and Anne, who's just a really, really warm individual, and then the ladies that picked me up from the airport. We had good conversation, and we went to eat, and we all got ridiculously full, and it was just, I mean, just sickening as full, how full we were. We're just on the verge of just, you know, going to the bathroom, you know what I mean? And so that was fun, and you know, I'm really, really grateful to be in Florida. It's an honor for me to be anywhere, and you'll hear by the end of my story how why I'm so thankful. But I'm originally from Greenville, South Carolina, and back home. Well, okay, cool. And back home, we lived in a little white house on a red clay road, and we got our water out of wells, and we had an outhouse, and we picked black raspberries for fun, and I'm from a family of Baptist ministers. And, yeah, listen, everybody, like, oh, we bet she's got a story. And I had flaming red hair and freckles growing up, and nobody else in my family did. And my brother informed me that the reason why I looked the way I did was because the mailman was my daddy. So whenever I saw him bringing, it's so funny, Al-Anons always go, oh. God love her. So whenever I would see the mailman coming down the road, I'd go, Daddy! And he would put his arms around me and tell me how cute I was and pat me on the head. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, because what I learned is that turned out to be a little pattern for me, actually. Where if you just put your arms around me and tell me how cute I was, that we were, well, basically married at that point. But so we stayed down south for a little while, and you know, my parents had great big dreams for me. I was I've been singing since I was 3, and they wanted me to be a famous gospel singer, and I was to take care of my family for the rest of my life, basically. And when you tell a 9-year-old that, that's stress. And so I remember, you know, just when my family actually sat me down and told me that, you know, we know you have talent, you're good, you know, you're from a good family, and we want you to just, you know, we want to work on you, we want you to go to voice lessons, we want you to do all this stuff, and so that we don't have to work anymore, basically. And you know, so, you know, I got on my little tricycle, and guess I'll get a paper out, you know what I mean, it's hot now. And so we stayed down there for a little while, and my dad got transferred up to Cincinnati, and in the process of him traveling back and forth from Cincinnati to South Carolina, he found him a girlfriend, and so when we, it was time for us to move, he did move us to Cincinnati, but he left, and he went, and he married his girlfriend up the hill, and that left my mother and to raise my sister, my brother, and myself. And I need to tell you that when I got sober, my mother was my biggest problem. I really, truly believed in my innermost self that if she would have just treated me the way she treated my brother and sister, that I would not be this loser sitting at an AA meeting saying, I'm an alcoholic. See, it was all her fault. And I need to tell you that my mother struggles with mental illness, and she does not believe in taking medication. And what she does is she sometimes just leaves and she disappears for sometimes days, sometimes weeks. And you know, it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've been able to love my mother through her episodes. Because see, you taught me that my mother, yes, she's my mother, but she has her own set of deal, her own set of problems that she came in and she deals with on a regular basis, and that it's not always about me. And what you've done, Alcoholics Anonymous, is you've taught me how to see my mother as a woman and not as my mother. And I've been able to use that service work that I was taught early on I think it's real easy sometimes for us to go to meetings and empty ashtrays and you know, be good and kind to other alcoholics. But sometimes it's real difficult to practice that at home. And you taught me how to practice it at home, and I'll be forever grateful. My mother is home as we speak. I just talked to her, and she doesn't, you know, think that I'm that big of a deal. And, you know, so every time I go out somewhere, she goes, "Why they fly you all over the place? What could you possibly have to say?" You know what I mean? That's so great that you get to travel all over the country and tell people. You know, it's like, well, I'm usually talking about you, Mother. And and it's a story that they like to hear. But in the end, she always wishes me luck, and she always tells me to call her when I'm done. And, you know, I my mother was not somebody who put her arms around me and told me that she loved me all the time. But my sponsor has taught me that love is an action word. And if I look at my mother's actions, my mother loved me in a huge way. And we got up to Cincinnati, and my mother decided that because she was from the South and she had cleaned bathrooms for a living, that she wanted us to have a better life and she wanted us to have a great education. And so she decided to send us to Catholic schools. So now I have a really huge red afro, a white blouse, a plaid skirt, Bobby socks, and black and white Spaldings. And it just didn't look normal. I mean, you know what I mean? It didn't. And, you know, it really truly did not. And I got beat up from, I got chased from school on a regular basis. And that's why I liked that movie Forrest Gump when it came out. And, you know, and I understood the run, Forrest, run. And so this one day, this girl named Squeaky was like 6'10 in the fifth grade. And her and her little posse used to chase me home all the time. And one day they stoned me. They were stoning me, you know, like how they do in Africa, where they just throw rocks at everything like it's going to hurt them. But they stoned me, and I ran in the house, and my mother was home. And I said, "Whew, I'm glad I made it home. They're about to kill me." And my mother goes, "You know, Angela, at some point you're going to have to learn how to take care of yourself. And what I'm going to need you to do is you go out there and you stand up to Squeaky." I said, "You want me to do what?" And she said, "Or you can stay in here and take the butt whooping that I'm going to give you," which I knew what hers felt like, and I only knew what Squeaky's appeared to be. So I went outside, and you know, I looked up at her, and I said, "My mother said I'm supposed to fight you." And she said, "Well, come on then." So I balled my fists up, and I closed my eyes real tight, and I reached up because I knew she was tall, and I said, "Pew!" And I got her right here. Oh, man. You guys are applauding violence? What is wrong with you guys in Florida? There's another part to that story before you clap. And so I reach up and I hit her right here, and oh my God, it was the happiest day of my life. You see, I had swung at the giant. Everybody was scared of her, but I hit her, and nobody else had. And now she didn't budge when I hit her. And she, you know, almost beat me to death. But I have this thing called alcoholism that helps me remember what I should forget and forget what I should remember. And what I forgot was that she, you know, damn near beat me to death. And what I remember was that I hit her. And from that point on, I fought everybody coming down the row. Didn't matter. I was a boxer. And I'll tell you what, all the way up into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I used to tell my sponsor, "Hey, she say, you know, I need you to empty the ashtray." I say, "Hey, sister, I've hurt people before." And my sponsor's from England, and she would go, "Lovely, could you still empty the ashtray?" "Yeah! Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and empty it this time." You know? And so that was my deal. And my mother, God love her, she came one day, my 12th birthday, and picked me up from school and took us to our house. We lived in the projects when we got to Cincinnati, and she took us to our new house, and it was beautiful. It's the same house that my mother lives in today, and it was a beautiful red brick flat house, which I love. One story, and it sits on a few acres, and you know, the whole tire on the, you know, string hanging from the tree kind of thing. And one day my friend Rebecca came over, and she had, let me tell you this first. It was an all white neighborhood that we moved into. So from the age of like 13 to 20, maybe 19, I wasn't even black anymore. I listened to Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band, and and my favorite girl group was Heart. I know, isn't it crazy? And the first concert I ever went to was Led Zeppelin, 1979. But I have to tell you this: I was at the Ted Nugent Foreigner concert, and I was there, and you know, Foreigner was doing their thing. You know what I mean? I have traveled a lifetime, spend my time so foolishly. And I remember just standing there looking around, man. I didn't see one black person. I was like, woo! I am bad. I said, they ain't got the nerve to come down here, but I'm down here. And that night, at that concert, I became a legend in my own mind. And everywhere I went and everything I did, everything was a song. That's all. It just played in my mind. And I lived my life through music, music, music. I mean, everything I did. I would walk into a bar and you know, the song that... profound words to the song from the Eagles, "Somebody's Gonna Hurt Someone." Before the night is through, somebody's gonna come undone. There's nothing we can do. Everybody wants to touch somebody if it takes all night. There's going to be a heartache tonight. A heartache tonight, I know. And that's the way it went. And you know, my friend Rebecca came over one night, and she had a brown bag, and it had some bottles in it, and it was Boone's Farm apple wine. And so, you guys are all sober, right? Nobody's had any Boone's Farm this evening, have they? Speak at my church every Sunday, and when I tell them about Boone's Farm, they don't react like that. So I start hanging out with these girls, these five white girls, man, and they could do whatever they flipping wanted to do, you know. I was over at their house one night, and Rebecca's mother said, "Rebecca," I love that voice, "Rebecca, your father and I have been conversing, and..." "And we feel that, seeing as you're drinking alcohol now, that we would appreciate it if you would drink at home and not out in the street. And that way, we would know you were safe." And I remember looking at her going, "What did she just say?" And she goes, "They want us to drink at home." I was like, oh my God. I thought that was the most closest, lovingest family I ever met in my life. I remember going home to my mother going, "You mind if I have a beer?" And she goes, "Not in this lifetime." You know, so it wasn't happening there. And, so I hung out with these girls, and I don't mean any disrespect. I know that I'm an alcoholic. It's a few drugs in my lead. I apologize. Just, you know, tell Ann. Where's she at? You got a problem with it, tell Ann or Lee. Yeah, don't tell me, because I'll hurt your feelings. And so I hung out with these girls, and we drank. Oh, my God. We just had the time of our lives. And, you know, smoked a little weed. Couldn't really get with that. It seemed like I smoked it and then ate everything in everybody's freezer. You know what I mean? God, had been there for about 5 years. You know what I mean? And, you know, and then got involved with, you know, a little acid, and it got me a mental health diagnosis. And but I have to tell you this. One night, my friend Rebecca and it was three of us actually in the car I was driving, and they gave me these two little pills, and they said, you know, only take one, but, you know, I took two. And it was strawberry mescaline. I know, that's exactly what I thought. And so I take these two pills, and we're driving, and then they decided they want to go to McDonald's. And about half point there, things got colorful for me. They, you know, just everything was just flowing. And so we pulled into McDonald's, and then we pulled up to the little yellow box. You know, and so, you know, I roll the window down, and there's some, you know, some little guy in there going, you know, "What do you want? What do you, you know, well, what do you want?" You know, don't ask me, well, what do you want? So I'm arguing with this, you know, little guy in the yellow box. And, you know, I really truly believe without a shadow of a doubt, you know, by the size of that box, I, you know, basically got beat up on a regular basis. But I could take him because he probably wasn't about this big. You know what I mean? So I knew that I could take him, so I was not afraid of him, you see. And we argued back and forth, he and I. And then I got to the next window, and they wanted my money, so I'm arguing with them. And, you know, then I get to the third window, and he's pushing bags, and I'm pushing them back in there. You know what I mean? And so, they call the police, and, you know, just a whole shebang. And, you know, oh, she's disturbing the peace. And the police officer comes, and, you know, he looks like Fred Flintstone. You know what I mean? And I'm just looking at him, and he asked me my name, and I told him it was Luke Skywalker, and you know, they don't take too kindly to that falsification thing. And so I go, and he looks in the car, and now my car won't move, and I said, "Officer, I don't know what's wrong," and he goes, "In America." That's how his voice sounded. "In America." And I was like, "Oh, dude, I know I'm going to jail." He goes, "When we want our cars to go, we put them in park." My car wasn't even in park. So he goes, "Pull over there." And he began talking, and his face was just going in different directions. And so I told him, "Dude, just here. Just put the handcuffs on me, because there's not going to be an explanation in about 10 minutes. So, you know, he takes me to jail. They call my parents, and, you know, they call my mother and said, "Hi, we have your daughter down here at the police station." And my mother goes, "Well, make sure she stays warm," and hangs up. I didn't have enabling parents. My parents truly believed that, you know, if I chose to go that direction in my life, that was fine. But they had other children that they had to raise, and that's kind of how, you know, my stuff was. And, you know, and I'll tell you what, I took my first drink of alcohol, and I hear people, I travel speaking all the time, and I hear people say on a regular basis, "Well, you know, when I took the first drink, I got sick, I got this." I'll tell you what, when I took the first drink of alcohol, I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that I made a conscious decision that day that I would drink every opportunity I got. Because, see, when I took that alcohol and I put it into my system, it transformed me in a way. There was feelings that moved through my body that started from the bottom of my feet and rose. I based some of my relationships on the way to that first drink. You know what I mean? If you can make me feel that way, we were good to go. You know what I mean? And forever. You know what I'm saying? And I based a lot of relationships based on that first drink. And my dad got me a job at a recording studio, and so I was working there on the weekends. And one day I was there, and I was singing in the bathroom, and I don't know, if you're an artist like I am, it's like you hope and pray, especially when I was a little girl, I did anyway, that somebody would just discover me, that just one day I'd be somewhere, and, you know, I'd be humming or something, and somebody would go, "Oh my God, you sing really good. My name's Bob from Epic Records, and I have a contract." You know what I mean? No work at all that I was going to do. And that happened for me, actually. And I came out of the bathroom, and there was a tall gentleman standing there that told me he could make me famous and that he had never heard a voice as powerful as mine. And he said, "I can make you famous, but you'll have to come to Las Vegas with me." I said, "Really?" And he goes, "Yeah." So I went home. I called a family meeting, and I went home, and I was a, you know, disturbed child. So if I called a family meeting, they knew it was going to be crazy. So I sat them all down, and I said, "I will be back for you." "Once I have made it famous and I get a Grammy, I'll be back." And my dad kept things real simple. He would just look at me and go, "Something is wrong with you." And, you know, and my mother usually agreed. So I had my mother there saying, "Angie, please don't go." And my dad saying, "Angie, please don't go." And my little sister saying, "Angie, please don't leave." And my brother also. And I made a decision to go to Las Vegas with this man. At the age of 17, I was a young girl in Las Vegas, singing in casinos, drinking and having the time of my life, and opening up for some of the biggest people, and just drinking and having. I lived in a hotel, and it was just a party every night. But something strange began to happen. I began to not remember stuff. And I didn't know anything about a blackout until I came to AA. I personally believe that if you didn't remember what you did, you had one hell of a time. You know what I mean? And, you know, and then people would tell you what you did, and then you have to go drink again because it's so disgusting. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, and I'm, you know, waking up with different people, you know, jeez, you know, toothless guys named Zeb, you know. You know, and he's going, but you told me you loved me. It's like, oh, did I, Zeb, now? Okay, great. Beautiful. Now, I'm going to run. And we're laying next to each other. He's got one tooth and it's gold. You know what I'm saying? And just insanity, insanity. And, you know, this guy that I went to Las Vegas with ended up having his own issues. And he ended up having a little heroin problem. And you guys are funny. I mean, really, it's just like everybody, oh, yeah, heroin, yeah. And so I, he ends up introducing me to that. And so as a young woman, I was drinking alcohol on a regular basis and shooting heroin intravenously and began to get blacklisted in casinos, couldn't get a job anywhere. And, you know, people would say things to me. It wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I heard that the first drink was the problem, because, see, that wasn't what I was being told. You know, they said, drink two drinks. Stop at two, Angie. You know what I mean? If you're going to, you know, smoke weed before you drink. You know what I mean? Do whatever you have to do, but just don't drink over four. You know, and I truly did, until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believed that the fourth drink was the one that truly got me in trouble. And then I heard, drink wine, just drink wine, you know, or drink beer, you know, or drink light beer and lose weight. You know what I mean? And it was just like I had all this stuff going on in my head. And so I stayed out here with this gentleman, knowing absolutely nothing about him, and he became abusive. And I wasn't making any money anymore, and he wasn't making any money anymore, and we had this this drinking and drug problem, and he became more and more abusive. And one day he came and got me and said that he needed me to drive him to the store, and I drove him to the store, and when he went in and he shot and killed the owner. And when he came back out, he had the blood on him, and he told me to drive, and that's what I did. And I need to tell you that for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't stay sober because I didn't want you to know that. I didn't even want you to know that somebody like me was involved in something like that. And, you know, it's hard to fathom when at the age of 13, when I took that drink of alcohol, that nobody could have ever told me that something like that was going to happen. And so what I do is I go on trial. And I'm in Las Vegas, and my face is plastered all over the news, and I'm listening to this family constantly telling me how bad of a person I am. But see, me, the way that I thought about it was I just couldn't believe. It was so surreal for me. I just could not believe that something like that happened. It was like everything just seemed like a dream. And he is still in prison as we speak. And I ended up not having any charges, but also being given a floater out of the state of Nevada. And what that means is, for no reason can I ever, ever return. And me personally, I have not found it necessary to return. And I'll tell you, it's just an interesting deal, because in March of this year, I got a phone call from Las Vegas, and it was a guy from the specific group who asked me to come and talk. And I said, you know, I'm not sure that's a good idea. And he said, we've already had you checked out, and you're good to go. And but, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm like, this is a setup if I ever seen one. You know what I mean? If I ever seen one. So I said, well, Mr. Specific Group, you know, I'm going to have to talk to an attorney. And so I talked to an attorney, and they check it all out, and it was true. I could go back to Las Vegas. And I had one of my friends look this woman up, because it was one of those amends that I didn't think I'd ever, ever have to make. And I got a hold of her, and I asked her if I could meet with her. I told her who I was, and she said that she would meet with me, and I met with her. And it was the gentleman's wife. And I told her, I said, I know that I can't ever bring him back, but is there anything that I can do to right this situation? And she said, it sounds to me
like you should just keep doing what you're doing. And she put her hands on my hands and she said, honey, you're a child of God. And I told her about my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she shared a story with me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to put my arms around her and tell her that I truly, truly am doing everything I can do to not practice that kind of behavior ever again. One day at a time, I strive for that. And the little girl was about 6 at the time, so she was a grown woman. And I was able to tell her the exact same thing. See, one of the things that's so interesting about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we can never, ever really dictate what's going to happen on the journey. That's why I'm real thankful that you guys told me to strap in on the driver's side, on the passenger side, and go for the ride, because it's going to be amazing. And when that day came, when I could make amends to that woman, then and only then was I truly a free woman, where I could walk the streets with my head held high and know that I had nothing following me. And if you don't know what that feels like, you keep coming back and keep coming back, because it's a marvelous, marvelous deal. And so I came back to Cincinnati and I said, you know, I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to do anything. You know, I'm done. And that lasted all of about 3 weeks. You see, I got this thing called alcoholism, and I didn't know at that time that I could not drink. I had no idea. And so every time that I said I was not going to drink, I meant it from the bottom of my heart. That's one of the reasons why when people drink again, I don't give them a hard time. Because every single time that I said I wasn't going to drink again, I meant that from the bottom of my heart. But I didn't know that I was powerless over alcohol and that it dictated and managed my life. I didn't know that. But to the untrained eye, we appear liars. To my mother, I was a liar. To my father, I was a liar. But to you guys, see, you guys got me. That's why I keep coming back to AA, because you guys get me. I can tell you things and you understand. But if I told my church that I was looking out at the congregation and they all look like beer bottles with hairstyles, you know, I don't think they'd understand that, nor would they want me up there anymore. But you guys got me. And we were riding this bus one day on Sundays in Cincinnati. It's you could ride the city bus for free. It's called Sunday Pass Riding. And my brother and sister and I were all on the bus, and we got down to the inner city, and there was a intersection there called Liberty and Vine, and it was this little restaurant there, and you know, it was all these, you know, pimps and prostitutes and Cadillacs, and you know, they were listening to Shaft on their little 8-tracks, and I remember my brother looked over there and he said, boy, you couldn't pay me to go over there. And then my little sister looked over there and goes, shoot, me neither. And I was sitting there thinking, shit, I'm going over there tomorrow. You know what I mean? So I started riding the bus from where I lived to downtown on a regular basis, and drinking in some of the worst bars, seeing some things that I never, ever thought I would see, and just drinking and going down rapidly and don't even know it. And I started, my friends, you know, I don't know how your friends were, but my friends, they taught me how to write other people's checks. My friends did. And, you know, I began the journey of committing crimes. And I went to jail and took a physical and found out that I was pregnant. And I was headed to the penitentiary with a 7 to 25. And I can tell you that the only reason why I didn't lose my mind when I went to the penitentiary was because my baby was growing inside of me. And every opportunity I got, I would rub my stomach and I would tell my child, I'm going to be a good mother. I'm going to do everything I can to be a good mother. And I meant that from the bottom of my heart. And I had my son, and the warden came to me and told me that because of the amount of time that I was doing, that I would have to find somebody to take my baby. And by this time, my parents weren't talking to me. I was out on my own deal and on my own journey. And I had to call my mother and tell her that I had a baby and that I was in prison. And I said, I need you to come and get my child. And they came and they got my child, but they did not stop to visit me. They came and they got him. And so I watched my child leave from the penitentiary through a slit this big. And I said to my baby, I said, when I get out, I'm going to do the right thing. And I meant it. I meant it from the bottom of my heart. When I got out of the penitentiary, my son was 4. I'm on the bus headed downtown to Cincinnati, headed down the highway to Cincinnati. And all the way on the bus, all I could think about was seeing my child. That's all I could think about. I got off the bus and suddenly, if you've read it, it's more about alcoholism. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that I'd hadn't had a drink in a while. Surely one won't hurt me. And I went to that bar and I had that one drink, and the next time I saw my son, he was 10. I'm not really too confused about the powerfulness of the disease of alcoholism, you see. Looking back through the step work that I've done, I realized that I let my children go like they were a pair of jeans. One of the things that I said when I got sober was that I gave my kids up for adoption because I wanted them to have a better life. But see, the reality of it is, and what I like about AA is that when you work the steps time and time again, there's a level of honesty. I don't have to be honest with you, but I most certainly have to be honest with me. And what I realized was I didn't take care of my children because they stood in the way of my drinking. And I had to admit that to myself, you see, because the coins that I get from my sponsor always say, "To thine own self be true." And I had to get honest about that so that I can move on, because it talks about it in the book. It talks about this martyr thing that we do sometimes. And thank God that I was able to get honest about myself, because I'd have thought that I did something really, really good. Now, in retrospect, it was a wonderful, wonderful move. My children have had great lives, and I knew that that would not happen with me. And one night I was downtown Cincinnati and at a bar, and went to some people's house and started drinking and shooting dope intravenously, and somebody shot ice water into my veins. And by this time I was living on the river and in a boarding house for women. And after I got the water shot in my veins, it was the closest thing to death that I ever felt. And I remember with every step that I took, I asked God, "If you just get me through this, I won't drink anymore." Because the worst thing that I want to happen was for my parents to have to know that that's the way that I died. And I walked those 17 blocks. And I believe in angels to the utmost. Because when I got back to that boarding house, there was a little white blonde woman standing there. And she looked at me and she said, "You do not have to keep living like that." And she went up to my room with me and she put a rag on my head and she began to tell me about her drinking. And for the first time in a long time, I heard somebody who felt, not drank the way I did, but felt the way that I did. She asked me if I would go someplace with her, and at that night, I would have went anywhere with anybody if it would have made me feel better. And so I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when she took me to my first meeting, it was at a clubhouse. So there was about 200 Harleys parked out front, and all these white people with white cups, and I thought, well, this should be an interesting party. And, you know, I was walking up the walkway, and everybody was so friendly. They said, "Welcome," introduced themselves. I said, "Well, that's nice." And then I got to the steps getting ready to go up, and this big biker guy grabbed me, picked me up, and he goes, "Welcome to AA. My name is Squirrel." And I said to Squirrel, I said, "Squirrel, man, you're going to need to put me down, man. Really." She said, "Let's go into the building." And we went into this huge room, and she said, "Somebody's going to tell their story." And I sat real close to the wall, because, you know, in case it was contagious or anything. And this guy began to tell his story. And he talked about sleeping under a bridge. And it seemed to me, newcomer mentality, it seemed to me that the whole room bust out laughing. "Ah-ha! Ah-ha!" And I remember thinking, "Whoa." And he said, "And I used to beat my wife," and it seemed like the whole room busted out laughing. I said, "Man, these white people crazy." And then after he said all he said, then everybody got up and held hands and prayed. I said, "Lord, and they hypocrites too." She said that, we always thank the speaker. And I said, "Well, good, because I got a couple questions I want to ask him." So he pulled in here and said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, little lady." I said, "Oh, look here, brother. You know, your buddy's laughing at you, dude." And he goes, "Excuse me?" I said, "All your friends here in your little club." I said, "They laughing at you." And he said, "Oh, sugar baby, you just keep coming back." I said, "Oh, no, you keep coming back. I just heard your story." And I stayed around AA for a little while, and, you know, wasn't like I had a huge social schedule or anything. So I stayed around AA. You know, it's just me and what felt like me and all these white people. You know what I mean? And so I thought that alcoholism was a white people thing. But I stayed around AA for a while and militant, mad. Everything was because I was black. If it was, a girl was given a lead one night and she goes, you know, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't really like black people. But thanks to God and my sponsor in AA, I do. And I was the one out there that stood up and goes, well, we ain't going nowhere. Come to the people. We here for the long haul. And my sponsor would go, would you sit down? I say, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and sit down, but I'm going to need to talk to you, too, about this sponsorship thing. I mean, you white and I'm black. You know I'm a little sensitive with civil rights and all. And I said, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, my ancestors picked cotton. And she goes, what? You don't even wear cotton underwear. And I said, see, I don't know if this little sponsorship thing gonna work between me and you. But so like I said, I stayed around AA, and about this time, people start coming into AA with this little crack problem. I know they don't have crack in Florida. But in Cincinnati, we got issues with it. And they were coming into AA, and, you know, everybody weighed the same thing, you know. And you know, their eyes were big, and, you know. And I said, well, I guess y'all can stay here. Don't talk. Maybe they'll come up with a Crackaholics Anonymous. But right now, you're in AA, and I'll be your sponsor. So anybody that came in smoking crack into AA, I automatically was their sponsor. And I took them hostage and kept them back at the round table at the back of the room. And I'd read the big book to them at the top of my lungs. And, you know, and if they wanted to go to the bathroom, you know, I'd go with them. You know what I mean? Because, you know, their sobriety was very important to me, you know. And I knew if they stayed away from me too long, the possibilities of them smoking it again was high. And so I was standing outside the men's bathroom. I said, come on out of there. What you doing? We don't smoke in here. Come on out of there. And then one day, this is amazing. I'm telling you that story to tell you this. Because one day, I was sitting at a meeting. There wasn't a cloud on the horizon. Everything was going pretty good in my life. And suddenly, the thought crossed my mind. You guys. They're over here going, oh my God. Oh no, Lord, no. And that this seat should go to somebody who really needs it. And I decided that night, being the martyr that I am, to give up my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called my sponsor and told her, you know, what I had come up with in less than 30 minutes. And she says, well, I'll see you and hopefully you'll make it back. If you make it back. And I was like, oh, well, I don't really see why I need to come back. But thank you anyway. And I figured since I'd been in AA telling them, you know, that I'd been here for a little while, that surely everybody would want to know if I was leaving. So I went to the Wednesday night 8:30 meeting. They asked if it was any AA-related announcements. Let you know what kind of AA I was, don't it? So the old timer goes, Angie, and I said, yeah, look here, people, drunks, people. I'm a roll on up out of here, and thank you for the real thick book, and, you know, I hope y'all keep coming back and live and let live, and... But I'm a roll on up out of here, and so you know how old-timers are, how sensitive they are. So this one got up and goes, well, get out of here then. There's people trying to stay sober. We'll see you if you make it back. I was like, you've been talking about sponsor. So see, y'all have been talking about God using you as an instrument. And I said, you know what? I think God using me as an instrument too. And I think what he want me to do is go find some black people and bring them into AA. So I grabbed my big book, stepped out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous onto the street to the bus, said, first black person I see that even appears to be an alcoholic. I'm going to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got on the bus, and then brother got on, and he was, you know, staggering. You know, I said, bingo. And I slid over next to him on the bus. I said, look here, brother, you been drinking? He said, yeah, I had a little something, something. I said, you know, you might be an alcoholic. So he started cussing me, you know, cussing me out and everything. And I said, you know, the people at the AA club told me that you would probably react like this to my information. So I think what I'm going to have to do is give it to you in a way that you will understand, in the way that I know how to give it to you. And hopefully you will hear what I have to say. And I opened the book up to chapter 5, and I stood up in the aisle of the bus, and I said, Riley! Did you hear what I said? I said, Riley! Have we seen a person fall who is falling, falling on our path? Those who do not recover are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And the bus driver said, oh, hell no, you got to get off this bus. So he puts me off the bus. I call him an alcoholic, too. And I made my way on down to the bar where I knew it was some black drunks. And, you know, I went into the bar, and they were dancing, having a good time. So I pulled the plug out the jukebox, and I said, look here, black alcoholics. They got a place for you called the AA Club. You, too, can stop drinking, such as myself. And they said, well, what you doing down here? I said, oh, no, well, I graduated. And I promise you, when I walked out of that clubhouse that night, drinking was not on my mind. It truly was. To go and help these people, these pitiful, pitiful people, drunk with no solution. And it was my job. So I was an evangelist for Alcoholics Anonymous. So they said, girl, if you don't put that plug back in that jukebox, we will beat you down. I said, hey, the people at the AA Club told me that you probably react like this to my information. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have to give it to you the only way that you'll listen and the only way that I know how. So I climbed up on the stool, went to the bar, sat on the bar, and read at the top of my lungs. I said, Riley! Do you hear what I say? I said, Riley, have we seen a person fall who has fallen, followed our path? Those who do not recover are those that are constitutively incapable. And the bar owner goes, oh, hell no. You got to get out this bar. So he put me out of the bar and locked the door. And I stood outside the bar contemplating. When suddenly the thought crossed my mind that surely one drink won't hurt me. And I asked the bartender to give me a shot of gin. I took that shot of gin, and 45 minutes later, I was in a crack house. I ain't thought about smoking crack. Well, that was for them. And I tell you that to tell you this, that what I've learned on my journey is that any time that I stand in judgment of any person, place, thing, or situation, that I have just set myself up to experience it on some level in my life. And what I found out was I had a whole lot of amends to make to those people who I called myself sponsoring. And I don't mean any disrespect. I know I'm an alcoholic. There's no doubt in my mind. And, you know, if it wasn't for crack cocaine, I'd have been out there probably a lot longer. It rushed me back in. So I came back in June the 20th, 1991, and I was part of the Little Bitty Waist Committee. And, you know, my hair hadn't been combed, and I was sitting at the back round table like this. I had been out in the streets. I had had the same clothes on for 3 weeks. And I was a mess. And I walked into the coffee bar, and that same old timer that was there that night when I gave my departure speech, he saw me and he looked at me and he said, Angie, you're going to die. And I said, I know. I need you to help me. And so he got a big book off the shelf and he gave it to me. He said, I want you to start reading this book. He said, but before you start reading it, I want you to go out there and I want you to shake everybody's hand coming through the door. Like I said, I was dirty and nasty. And I didn't want, and I said, but you don't understand, look at me. He said, I don't care. And I stood there and I reached my hand out. And a lot of people walked past me. But for those people that should go into AA and you don't have a place to live and you don't have a job. Because he took me to the book where it said job or no job, wife or no wife. My primary purpose is to help another person achieve sobriety. And so when I came back, I called my sponsor and talked to her, and she came down to meet me. And if it wasn't for those people in AA who let me stay at their house, I would be at AA meetings all day long, and I would be so tired and so hungry, and people would take me to their homes. And then what they saw was my willingness to stay sober. I'm the wrong woman to talk to if you're African American and you come into AA and you say you don't fit because there's not a lot of blacks. I'm the wrong one to talk to because those people took me into their homes and they saw my desire to stay sober. And I began working the steps with my sponsor. And I began going to start to go to more meetings, and I got an institution meeting where I was going to the jail. And I just started doing what my sponsor told me to do. Because, you see, I was properly horrified and thoroughly convinced that when I put alcohol in my system, what happens to me don't happen to the normal person. When my brother takes a drink of alcohol, he goes to work. I take a drink of alcohol and I'm on the evening news. That's the difference in our drinking. And so I started doing this deal, thank you, because I was scared of getting electrocuted. Thank you. So I just started doing this deal, and I did this deal the way they did it in the book, and my sponsor, and I've had the same sponsor since I came in, two totally different people who grew up together in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I asked her to sponsor me, she didn't like black people, and I didn't like anybody, so we were pretty much good to go. And when I asked her, it was because they said, you have to get a sponsor. You got to get a sponsor. You got to get a sponsor. You know why I asked my sponsor? Because she pulled up to this clubhouse one day. She was in a candy apple red sports car. She had like a little Mr. T starter set on and rings on every finger. And I said, well, there goes my sponsor right there. Because you told me that I should want what she has. So, I love my sponsor. Like I said, I've had the same sponsor, and she is just an amazing woman, and I hope the day comes when you'll be able to meet her, because I truly, truly believe that it's because of her and the action that she took in AA that plays a big part in my being here today. And she taught me and continues to teach me in a huge way. And so we worked the steps, like I told you, I have a daughter, and my daughter is 19, and she attends attends Grambling State University in Louisiana. And at 5 years sober, thank you, it's not by my doing, but at 5 years sober, my family, who raised my children, asked me if I would step out of their lives. I had shown back up to see my kids, and they began to act out and begin to do things that was not in their nature to do, and I knew it was because I was there. And so they asked me to just leave and go on about my business. And it wasn't until last year that I actually went to somebody's house on Thanksgiving and Christmas. You see, it was hard to live in the same city and know that my kids were around and I couldn't be with them. But it said selfishness, self-centeredness, we must be rid of it. And for the first time in my life, I made a selfless decision. And that was to let my kids have the same opportunity that I had growing up, and I had great opportunities. And my daughter's 18th birthday, she called me and told me that she wanted to see me. And I went to see her. You see, here's what's interesting, is that as my children were growing up, I was always at their soccer games, but I was in disguise. And I was always at their basketball games, you see, because I had to be there. And if you're a mother, you know what I mean. I just had to see them. And I was at every single one. I remember when I was drinking and my daughter would be in daycare, that this lady would let me come and see her in the daycare. She would be in her baby bed, and she would never be asleep when I came. she would just be laying there. And the only thing she would do is smile at me. But if my parents knew that I was there, it would have been, you just don't understand. So she called me and I went and got her and she spent all my money at the mall. She spent every damn dime I had at the mall. But see, I didn't say to God when I prayed that I wanted to see her and keep my money. See, I, you know, my sponsor told me I had to be a little more specific. And we had a good day that day. And when I dropped her off, I was able to make amends to her and let her know that I loved her and I have loved her all her life. And she put her arms around me and she told me that she loved me too. And she walked away. And then she called me when she was ready to go to college and asked me if I would take her to the airport. And I took her to the airport. And see, gosh, if I got what I deserved, I'd have never saw my kids again. And all the way to the airport, she laid her hand on my shoulder. See, this is what I'm saying. If I got what I deserved, she would not speak to me. But what she did was laid her hand on my shoulder and she began to tell me of stuff in her life. And we got to the airport and she got checked in. And there was a sense of, that I was losing her again. And she checked her bags in and she began to walk away and she turned around and she said, I love you, Mommy. And I said, Whitney, I love you too. And she got on that plane and she's been calling me 2 and 3 times a week since she's been in school, asking me those things that daughters ask their mothers. And when the hurricane hit, she was in Louisiana. And we hadn't heard from her for 6 days. And she called me. And she was so scared. And she was all the way down there. And I couldn't get to her. And she said, would you say that one prayer that you always say? Please. And that prayer that I say to her and with her is, God, I offer myself to thee. To build with me and to do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. And take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And she said, thank you. Thank you. I don't know what I can do, but I'll do something. These are the gifts that I've received in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my daughter is now dating a white guy. That's her man. And she will hurt you about her man. She's a good kid and so is he. They're both really, really good kids. And my son is 24 and he's a rapper. So I told him to please stay in school because I've heard him rap. I got my GED in Alcoholics Anonymous. 1999. And I'm in college. Working on a liberal arts and social sciences degree with a focus on all addictions. And I just got my certification in addiction studies through the University of Cincinnati. God has been extremely good to me, you guys. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I have nothing to complain about, nothing to be sad about. It's all good. Everything in the ride is just good. And it may not seem like there's a light at the end of the tunnel, but I kid you not, if you're new in this room, there is a light that shines so big. And if you just get to the other side, you will be amazed before you're halfway through. A long time ago back home, my grandmother used to hum this song. And I didn't know what it meant then, but I most certainly know what it meant, what it means now. Do you mind?
No.
And I will close with this.
amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see.
God bless.
We have a little something for Angie.